Welcome to the Women Shifting Gears podcast driven by Hemmings. This is your home for inspiring conversations with women leading the way throughout the automotive spaces. I'm your host, Amanda Busick, and the power of this podcast is in the strength of this community. We believe that high tides rise all ships, and to each of you collaborating together to steer this ship forward, we see you, we recognize you, and we salute you. It's time to set sail. Another episode of Women Shifting Gears starts now. What is your life's purpose and how do you find it? If there's one thing we'd want from you to take from this episode of the Women Shifting Gears podcast driven by Hemmings is that it is absolutely possible to fully live your purpose in this life. Our Beyond Inspirational guest this week, Sharon Bronner, is doing just that. Named as president and CEO of the National Corvette Museum just 4 months ago, Sharon joins us as she gets up to speed in her new role. Being a female CEO in a male-dominated museum space, her background as a car chick, and all the moments in her life that had led her perfectly into this position. If you're struggling with taking the leap in hopes of a new possibility, this is the podcast for you. On this week's Women Shifting Gears podcast, driven by Hemmings, the president and CEO of the National Corvette Museum, Sharon Bronner, joins us. And Sharon, I want to kick back off to the very beginning of September. It was announced that you were joining the National Corvette Museum. I imagine it's been a very few busy couple of months for you. Walk us through that.
Oh my gosh. Yes, it has been a whirlwind of activity, an exciting time. Clearly, when you're stepping into a role like this, so many emotions surrounding the opportunity to be a chief executive officer. And in an industry of museum, first of all, having spent 20 years in my previous role at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum, loving museums, understanding their place in our culture, their importance to all of us as we learn and imagine and allow ourselves to explore. Then also the other side of museums are the attractions and tourism industry. And I've spent a lifetime in this part of the world. And then on top of all that, I get to do it in the car world. You know? So I'm a car chick. That's what I say all the time, even though I guess that's not even a politically correct term anymore. But I can say it when it's about myself. So, you know, the Corvette has always held a very special place in my heart all of my life. And so when you get to combine all things that you love, what could be even more fun than that. So all the nervousness sort of fell away and it was just have fun, Sharon, just have fun. This is what you have been working your whole life for. Wow. This will be extremely natural if you just have fun with it. Rely on the things you've learned and bring forward just the passion. And I think that is what I have tried to do this entire time in my soon to be first 4 months. Wow. January 1st will be my 4 month mark. Learning the place, the people, getting some context and history on a place that is 27 years old. And where do we want to go? What do we want to be when we grow up? Right. And determining what the face of the museum needs to be as it goes into its next evolution.
I definitely want to dive into all that. I want to go back to you taking on this position. How did you find out about the role?
Well, I made the decision to leave the Hall of Fame in Nashville after almost 20 years. It was a hard decision, as you can imagine, having been someplace for that long. I love country music about as much as I love the Corvette. It is my preferred genre of music. And, you know, when I went to work there, I thought I would retire from there. I really did. And, you know, we achieved a lot in that 20 years. We dug our way out of debt. We wound up having, you know, we went from about $35 million in debt to $32 million in reserve, operating reserve funds when I left, and expanded. And we went through floods and we went through tornadoes and we went through all kinds of things and the learnings and the opportunity to grow the collection and all these things. And I thought, you know what? We've done a lot and it's been a heck of a ride. But I think I need a break. And so I made that decision with my family and didn't really know what I wanted to do next. It was one of those things where you get to that point sometimes in your career or in your life and you're like, I'm going to take a hot second here and recharge and determine what do I want to do next. And so when that announcement came out, you know, I got the phone calls of, what do you mean you're leaving? You know, nobody anticipated that. And I got that phone call from one of our board members, Lon Helton, who has known me for the entire time I'd worked there. And he and I knew that he loved Corvette and he had been very involved in the Corvette Museum. And so he called me and said, what do you mean you're leaving? And I said, yeah. He goes, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, there could be an opportunity maybe at the Corvette Museum if you think you'd be interested. And I'm like, really? And he said, yeah, we are going to be looking for a new CEO. And I said, you're kidding. And he said, nope, not kidding. So you think about it. And here's the search team that's going to be conducting it. And if you think you're interested, then you just pick up that website and go apply. And I said, I believe I will. So it was just all divine time. And, you know, I have referred to that numerous times about getting this position, that it has no doubt in my mind that God has had a plan for me since the moment I was conceived to the parents I had, loved cars, and particularly the Corvette, and all the steps in between, that every step of my life has been preparing me for this role. And I absolutely feel that way.
I think it's fascinating that, you know, a lot of times people just bear and grin things, right? They keep their head down and keep working. Have you thought about, like, let's say you never would have, you know, listen to that inner calling of that you had reached burnout. I mean, it's almost like you take that leap and what's unknown opens up for you. Have you thought about that? If, you know, if you wouldn't have said, you know what, I need to do something different for myself.
You know, because I did, I'll be candid. I really was thinking, okay, I love this museum. I love this music. I loved all the work. I did. It was really hard to say, I'm going to stop. I just had brunch, as a matter of fact, with one of my former colleagues, and I miss him so, such a great friend, and we did so many wonderful things together. But I am better today because I made that decision. And I must say, I didn't make this decision alone. I would be really remiss if I didn't give a lot of credit to my husband, who saw me struggle to make that decision, to say it's okay, to say it's time to do something else. To not just grin and bear it because I had so many other loves of the thing. And he was so supportive, as was my mother, who lives with us since my father passed a few years ago. My two daughters that have never really known me to work anywhere else in their lifetime.
Right.
And, you know, my stepchildren certainly as well, but different from their perspective, as you can appreciate, because I've only been with them for 9 years. So it was a family decision. But I couldn't have done that without their support to take a leap of faith. My gosh, I was going to walk away from my salary and we didn't necessarily, sure. You know what I mean? We're in the middle of a pandemic. And I mean, a lot of people probably thought I was crazy, but it really was the absolute best thing for me. And in every way, every physical way, mentally, spiritually, to take truly a leap of faith, to put it in God's hands and say, you know what's best for me. I'm going to be a good and dutiful servant and listen to what it is that you have in store for me next. And so I did. And look at me now.
The search committee went on to say that you were unequivocally their clear choice. What does it mean hearing that?
Oh my gosh. It makes me emotional, to be honest. You know, to come in as a female into a role, one in the museum field is pretty unusual. The museum field is predominantly men at the leadership role, and to be a female to run a museum meant a lot to me, and I knew I was up against those odds. And then you put on top of that, I'm in a museum that is predominantly about a topic that men are in tune to, no pun intended. But I knew that I could do it, and I believed I was the very best candidate. Lord knows my husband thought I was the best candidate. He's got to be the biggest cheerleader I've ever had in my whole life. No two ways about it. It's one of the reasons why I married him. But I did have that confidence to be able to say it. And I told them, I am your candidate. There is no one else who could be more prepared to do this than me. And I didn't say that from an arrogance perspective. I just truly believed it in my heart. And so to show them what I knew from a business acumen perspective was the easiest part. It was, will you have the faith to allow me to take this opportunity and see what we can do. And so I walked out of that final interview. I felt really great about it. I thought there were two people in that room. There were no way, no how they were going to let me be that person. And so when I did get the call, of course, immediately burst into tears because I was so excited. And then I did eventually get to talk to those two people on the board selection committee and asked them. I wanted them to be honest with me. And that's when I found out that it was an unequivocal 100%. There was no one else that wanted anybody else. And I was so overjoyed to know that they had that kind of confidence. And what that has said to me since taking the job is their continued support. That is, I can't even begin to explain how important that is, that even when I'm projecting something that they may not feel comfortable with or are ready to move in that direction, they hear me out and are willing to hear it from my perspective and then be able to have a great conversation in return. And that discussion and or debate, not argument, but debate, is such a healthy process. I appreciate it. I appreciate it so much. And so for them to have that kind of confidence is, it's extremely meaningful.
How did you celebrate the phone call?
Well, after I stopped crying, I had to obviously call my husband to tell him the good news. And he said, "Oh, I told you you were going to get the job. I told you it was going to be yours. There was no way it couldn't be yours." And so the most fun person to tell was my mom, wishing that my father were here to be a part of it all. That is the only major missing ingredient. He would be so excited. I just wish he could share in it all. And so telling her was the most fun because she was so excited for me and she knew how much it would have meant to my dad. And so we had that moment to share what that would have been like had he been here. That was the best part.
What'd she say to you?
Well, she too cried and she said, you do know surely how proud your father would be. And I said, I think so. And she said, what a moment this is. It's pretty surreal. And I said, yes, ma'am, it sure is. And I said, how will I do this without Dad here? He's always the person I called when I had a question about work. He was such a great leader himself. And she said, well, you can still talk to him. He'll just answer you differently now. And so I said, you're right. So a funny little story about all that is when Dad died, I was working at the Hall of Fame. And one of the departments that I oversaw was IT. And so my IT team, there were a couple of guys on the team that were real motorheads. They really loved cars and we talked about cars all the time. And so they knew how much I loved the Corvette and Dad, and they met my dad, and, you know, I always have pictures all over my office of cars that he restored and our drag racing cars and different things. And so they knew enough about me that when he passed, rather than sending flowers or the other traditional things, they decided to contact the Corvette Museum. And they purchased a memorial stone for my father and presented it to me. And having, of course, no earthly idea that 2 years later I would be working there. And so I loved it. I loved the fact that they knew me so well that that was what they purchased in order to give their respects to my father and to me in my loss. And so there is a memorial stone on the main boulevard, as we call it, in the museum with my dad's name on it. And so then when I got the job, I know that every day he is right there. And so I go by and say hello to Dad every day when I go to work. So I stop and I know exactly where his stone is on the boulevard. And so he is right there. As a part of all of it. And I know that may sound incredibly crazy, but it's the absolute truth. And so it's a life full circle moment for sure.
It sounds incredibly special.
It is. It is. I am incredibly blessed.
Well, I want to go back to the very beginning with you. And it seems like your parents have had a major influence on your life from the car side and as well as the motorsports side. Mm-hmm. Back in your childhood, your earliest memory around cars.
I asked my mother, when was the first time I went to a drag race? And because that's all I can remember is going to Beach Bend Park, to the drag racing strip there, and going to the amusement park, which was pretty cool as a kid, right? You got to do what daddy wanted to do, but you got to have fun doing it too. So she said, oh, I can tell you exactly the first time you went to Beach Bend Park to the drag strip. And I said, oh, okay, cool. When? She said, you were in my belly. So I have been hearing the rumbles of small block Chevrolets and big block Chevrolets and fuel injections and blowers my whole life. And I love the sound of a great car to this day. I mean, it's just something that when I hear another vehicle, I immediately perk up. And my husband said, that just makes you so crazy when you hear that, doesn't it? And I'm like, yes, it does. So yeah, I mean, I grew up loving John Force and Don Prudhomme and Shirley Muldowney. I remember when I got to meet Shirley Muldowney as a kid, I thought I just met the next best thing to Jesus himself. I thought that was all of it because she was killing it when I was a young girl, you know, Connie Coletta and on down the line. So, you know, whether it was the gassers or the top fuel or funny cars or whatever, they were my deal. And so, yeah, I've been going to drag strips since I was in my mama's belly.
Now, did your dad drive or was there someone in the family that took action to the strip?
Daddy was the predominant driver. He was also, of course, the engineer making all of the modifications to the cars and eventually went on to actually build race cars for other people, drag racing, of course, predominantly. And then we actually even pulled tractors with hot rod engines when I was a kid and all that sort of thing. Eventually, my mother, she drove as well when there were female nights at the drag
strip. Love it.
Mama would drive. And then we started going to the Ohio Valley Raceway just outside of Louisville, Kentucky. You know, the quarter mile strip at Beach Bend and then eighth mile up at Ohio Valley. And they had co-pilot night. And so I got to ride with Dad. And man, that was a mistake. I got it bad at that point. And then eventually I went on to drive myself. And, you know, he always loved it because I had such great reaction times because I was young, right? So he would always say, you can burn that tree down, girl, like nobody I've
yes.
ever seen. And so, you know, it was just always something we did. And so if it had engines, that's what we did. And so drag racing was the predominant thing. Like I mentioned, he went on to do hot rod pulling tractors mm-hmm. And actually came within an inch of winning the national championship for the National Hot Rod Tractor Pulling Association in Louisville when I was a kid. I want to say that was 1973. Don't quote me on that, but it was in the early 70s. Lost by an inch. And it was because the transmission blew because the repeated times they had to have a pull off, he and this other guy. And so we did that. We flew airplanes. So I went on to get my solo license. My mother got her solo license. And then we had motorcycles, and but mostly drag racing cars. And then eventually in Dad's retirement years, I say that because he retired from normal work at Fort Knox, Kentucky as a civil service employee. He and Mom started restoring classic cars. And then that became a full-time job. And they restored hundreds of cars wow. for people in their lifetime. Most of which, if it was a restoration modification job, they were going to roll out of there with a Corvette engine in them if Dad had anything to do with it. So it's been a lifetime of motorsports in every way, shape, form, and fashion.
I think what I love hearing about from the drag racing to the pilot's license to the motorcycles, and I've never really tried to make this correlation before, but when you think of the independence that each of those provide, how does that build confidence in a young person?
Mm-hmm. You know, you're exactly right. Those are not team sports per se. Mm-hmm. Yes, it takes a village if you're going to, you know, drag race, as you well know, when that car rolls into the pits, it's a group of people that are flying in there to determine what needs to be tweaked on the car from that run to make the next run better. As the weather's changing, do we change, you know, the jets in the carburetor so that we can actually have better fuel efficiency and firepower quicker? Are we changing, you know, gear ratios 1 week to the next, which we did a lot of, and that type of thing. So it took a village to pull off the race, but it really is all up to the driver at the end of the day. And so, you know, I remember my jobs as a kid. Early on, my job was to help cool off the engine when he came into the pit. So I have a red wagon, truly a red wagon. I still have it. It's on my front porch right now as part of my Christmas decor. And it held 5 gallon square jugs of water. And so it was my job to go get that water in between races and have it ready so that we could cool the engine off by flowing that water through the radiator back through the engine to get it cooled down as quickly as possible. That was my job. Eventually, my job was to be in charge of changing out the jets and the carburetors. And so that was my thing. Then eventually I started having to be the person watching Dad and the competition on who was able to cut that tree the quickest. Who could he back off of and not have to burn it down quite as badly? Or who was tending to want to run too fast and all that stuff. So the independence came not just from the driving, not just from the flying, but the understanding of how these things worked. And little did I even imagine all of that was going on in my brain at the time. You know, he knew it. That's why he put me in charge of those things. And Daddy always said, made it very, very clear, two things in my lifetime. Don't you ever let anybody tell you you can't do something just because you're a girl. Just don't even go there. And you can be anything you want to be. You just got to want it bad enough. So you got to put in the work. And that's sort of the philosophy by which I was raised.
I love that you sit as president of this museum. You said it's such a male-dominated industry and you also have daughters. What is it like for you for them to see you in this role?
It's super important. You know, I spent a good portion of their lives as a single mom. And so showing them strong work ethic and commitment to always be the best you can be, just like Dad always said, just put in the work and everything else will take care of itself. It's absolutely how they've been raised. They're both strong and independent in that way. And, you know, you don't even realize sometimes what your kids pick up on until they get a little older. And now, you know, my youngest is 20, soon to be 21. And the other is now a mom herself. And she was always my hardest. She gave me the most run for my money. But it has been nice to have her come back to me now that she's a new mom. And she even said, I'm really sorry about something I did. But you know, it's fun too to watch her in her young career. You know, she is right now, she's interviewing, she's working for HCA, a large hospital company, as you probably know. And, you know, she's wanting to move up. And she's only been there a year and she wants to move to the next thing and the next thing. And I said, honey, what's the ultimate goal? Can you see out that far? What do you want to be? And she studied human resources. And she said, I want to be the chief operating officer for a hospital. And I said, okay. And she said, before that, I'd like to know that I really can be an expert in human resources. But she has the business acumen and she gets it and she understands she's got to make all the right career moves to get there. Right. And so we coach through that and we talk through that. And so she's watching me and she'll ask me those questions. And so I love that. And then my youngest, she wants to be a lawyer. I wanted to be a lawyer. I remember thinking to myself that I really would have loved to have been a litigation attorney. I didn't have the confidence that I thought I could do it, even though my daddy said I could do it. I didn't think I could do it. And so my youngest absolutely has the confidence. Her and my father used to talk about politics and current events and all that type of thing. And he's, the major reason why she wants to be an attorney. And watching her just pound through that process and not be intimidated by it. And again, knowing that she is in a male-dominated field, doesn't faze them a bit. They don't even think about it. And so, you know, it's one that I passed that along and my dad did. And so, you know, my mom is one of those people. She's a human resources person. She worked for the United States government as well at Fort Knox and made sure I understood how to fill out an application when I was like 10. And I did the same thing with my kids. And they tell me all the time how their friends are like, how do you know all these words? Like, where did you get this vocabulary? And they're like, well, that's just how we were talked to. We weren't talked to as babies. We were talked to as adults our whole life. And I made them get a job when they were 14. That was just no question about it. you're getting a job next summer. Get ready. Figure it out. What do you want to do? Mm-hmm. So, they too love cars. And, you know, dad rebuilt and restored two cars specifically for them. And so they're not intimidated by power or speed or that the fact that it's girls, you know. Daddy got a big charge out of the fact that we'd roll into a car show and we'd have three or four cars and it was all girls that piled out of the driver's seat. That made him so happy. Oh, my word. So they've just been told, it doesn't matter that you're a girl. You do you, boo, and you'll be just fine.
Well done, Mom.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
The Corvette is known as America's sports car. Why does that name ring true?
You know, the understanding of the history of the passion and why Chevrolet and General Motors wanted to come out there and make a statement. I think it's indicative of America to not be intimidated by what others may have done, that America can do it and do it better. We didn't start off doing it better, but I think that over time that this car continues to be that symbol of American ingenuity, perseverance, and I think that's what makes it special. We do it our way. And that's one of the things that I think the Corvette community represents is the heart of America. When Chevrolet had, you know, that slogan at one time, the heartbeat of America, I believe is what it was. And man, they nailed it with that one. They understand their constituency quite well at Chevrolet. And the Corvette is the finest of all of them. And that allows people to identify with it, even if they never drive it. And I think that makes this car really special.
I have read that you, your daily driver might be a Corvette.
I have a 2019. Of course, that's a C7 Grand Sport, Arctic White. I named her Athena.
Okay.
So I name all my cars. And I, before owning a Corvette, all my cars before that were named after princesses. So I also have a Genesis. She is Princess Kate. Prior to that, I had Princess Leia and I had Princess Diana. I can keep going. And so when I was able to say, all right, it's time for me to buy that Corvette, because it was always on the, I have to have that, but only once I become a CEO.
Fantastic.
And who would have ever dreamed I'd be getting a Corvette when I became the CEO of the Corvette Museum?
You did. I think you did. I think you dreamed that. I think you made that happen.
You know what? Maybe I did. I don't know. But so when I was looking for her, I started thinking about what would I name this car. And so I said, it has to be a queen or a goddess. And so I rolled through a lot of names before I landed on Athena. And if you know anything about the goddesses, you know, she is the goddess of as a warrior. And she was known for her military strategy in particular. And so there's two reasons why I chose it. One, that whole strategy piece. I'm big on strategy. You can't just tactically move through something and expect to really move a needle. You have to have a real strategy about what you're doing, particularly when you're in leadership. And so I loved that about her strength. And then, of course, here in Nashville, since that's where I still do live in Nashville, although I have a place in Bowling Green as well, Athena is here in Nashville at the Parthenon. We have a replica of her. And so we are the Athens of the South in Nashville. And so I have wonderful ties here, obviously, because of my time in Nashville, but also to the hall. And so I thought, Athena, it just works. And so that's her name.
Well, as you start to assess the landscape of the NCM and where you are and rounding out your fourth month, are there some short-term goals that you have in mind?
Absolutely. When you say short-term, I'm going to say the first year.
Okay? Sure.
And I've already started to identify some longer-term visions and strategies, which I've just imparted on the board for the first time just a couple weeks ago at our first board meeting. So in the short term, it's really leveraging the assets we already have. The museum has spent, you know, a lot of its short life, really. 27 years sounds like a long time. It's really pretty short for a museum. You know, just in establishing itself, right? It has definitely had its ups and its downs over the years, both financially. Obviously, we've had natural disasters, now two of them, one being the sinkhole back in 2014, and then now a tornado here in the last little few weeks. So it's had its ups and its downs, but they have absolutely survived and survived well. And it's time to really invest in the museum itself that we have right now. And so we have started to set about a course of how will we really go through the entire building structure, the story. How will we take the collection we already have and assess it much more clearly? How do we really utilize it to the very best of our ability in telling the core story? And also begin to understand what we need in the collection so that, yes, we have a lot of cars and you have to have a lot of cars. Yes, that's absolutely true. But cars are really only one part of it. You need to be able to add color and texture to the story. So we need a lot more documentation, photography, interviews, oral histories, the smaller items, right, to add to this wonderful car collection, because that begins to really tell the deeper, more interesting parts of the story. And I believe that pulls in a different audience as well. You know, if you're not a car person or if you're not a Corvette person, you might go, well, I'm not particularly interested in going to see this museum. So we have to kind of break through that. And I think that's where our exhibition program and other programming that we want to do can really help us do that, both in the digital format as well as in the actual museum itself. So short term, looking at just this year, for example, you know, they did a temporary exhibit. It's called Corvette Powered. It's really quite good. It's pretty amazing. Some of the interesting cars and boats and other things that we have on display that are utilizing Corvette technology. But that would speak pretty hardcore to a Corvette audience, right? Unless you spin that up on its head a little bit and talk to the person who loves automotive history and power and engineering and science and technology. And you begin to take that one thing and begin to spin it so that the audience understands that there is something there more than just the Corvette story. I believe we can do that better. I don't think we've done that in that way in the past, because it's like, okay, well, this is our niche and this is our audience, and we're just going to talk to the Corvette person. But it would be pretty easy, I believe, for us to expand that audience right there. So you take that's an opportunity. When that closes in April, they had already made the decision before I arrived to bring in a traveling exhibition, and it's actually on Hot Wheels. And so what a great exhibition, right? Everybody can identify with Hot Wheels. So again, another way to open up our audience that we might not otherwise get. But the Corvette's always been a big part of Hot Wheels, for heaven's sake. So we will be inserting some of the cars from our collection into this Hot Wheels exhibit to really enhance it, to benefit us in a way that another museum might not be able to do. And so we're going to do that in the summer of 22, which will be a huge opportunity for us to grow our audience. And so because of that, we're going to take our kids area, which really hasn't had a whole lot in it. It's just sort of been a little tiny space. And we're going to blow that out. And we're going to take this opportunity to really expand and redo something that will permanently be there with us, that will really attract families to come back and to bring kids to engage with us also once Hot Wheels is gone. Super excited about that. We have some amazing donors that really are excited to help us fund this new kids area. And so we're excited to tell people about it. I haven't even announced it yet, but I'm telling you all that stuff. And then we're redoing an entire section of what I call the core narrative in the fall. And that will be called Driven by Design. And so it'll take up, I think it's around 6,000 or 7,000 square feet of the actual core exhibit, and really talk about the design of the car and its evolution. And inside that story, we're going to be able to talk about the women of design. And so there is a section about truly the women involved in the design of the Corvette, both the interior design and some also in the exterior of the design. And so doing the things that we need to do to be inclusive of all the people who have been a part of Corvette history. And yes, there are a lot of very wonderfully beautiful women involved, along with these amazing men who have been a part of this story all along as well.
Well, I know you're just getting your feet wet into this new role, but what do you want your impact to be in your tenure with the National Corvette Museum?
It's a great question. I want the museum to be, I've said to the staff numerous times, and I've said it to the board when I arrived, it's a good museum. It's good. It has all the things that you're supposed to find in a museum, and it's good. But I want it to be great. And we can be great, not just in what we have on display or what's in our storage facilities that are the collection, but what we do with it. How we make it available to people, not just in the physical presence of the structure, but then again, as I mentioned a moment ago, digitally, we can open up our stories to the world. And it isn't just the Corvette story, it's automotive history, it's art and design and color and engineering and technology and advancement and all of these things that make people realize there's something more here than just a car. I think it's a freaking fantastic car, but that's beside the point. There is so much more that has made this car be a part of American history and of the fabric of our society that makes us different than what happens in Europe or other countries that have made amazing and beautiful cars as well. But this is our story, and it's only our story. And so we need to embrace that. So I want people to understand that the Corvette Museum represents more than just a singular vehicle. It represents many, many other things that have impacted our culture here in America. So there's that. And then secondly, I want to impact Bowling Green. I want to impact Kentucky. I am a Kentuckian. I grew up literally about 35 miles north of Bowling Green in a very small town, Hodgenville, Kentucky. And so this is my last stop. I'm 57. And so I want to run at this as long and as hard as I can until I'm saying, okay, I think it's time for me to retire and enjoy my grandchildren. I have one so far. So it's my chance to make a mark on my home, to do something that can be impactful well beyond the years that I am alive, so that the city of Bowling Green grows. It is recognized for the beauty of what it is in Western Kentucky, that the industrial age that has happened there because the Corvette Assembly Plant came in 1981. What can we do as an organization to become this cherished community asset that is more than an attraction that sits out by I-65? What mark are we leaving on our community, both in Bowling Green as well as for the state of Kentucky and then the region of Western Kentucky? Those are things that are important to me. I think that our lives are here. We're here for a purpose. Sometimes we don't always understand what that purpose is. We keep looking for it. So leaving a legacy that allows people to continue to learn and to grow and to understand your place in it is what I believe is important for us to do. And so I think that this museum has every opportunity to do that, and I hope to help it get there.
I don't want to put words in the mouth of our listeners, but I'm pretty sure, as I do, they are going to sit here and know that it is very obvious why you were the clear choice for that search committee.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I do want to know, though, you mentioned this prior to the podcast, your nickname is Queenie. How'd you get that one?
Yeah. When I was at the Hall of Fame, I moved offices many times in my tenure there just for a variety of reasons. And so one particular location was a whole new area. We called it the West Wing because it wasn't really meant for offices, but it was one last place for us to put people. And so when they built my cubicle, because it didn't have a door, I didn't have a door there until the very end of my career. We just didn't have those opportunities. They promised me a nice big space so that I could have plenty of room spread out, because I oversaw a lot of what we did there. And so this office was, the desk was huge. And so, I mean, it was a big old U-shaped thing, and it was awesome. And so one of my staff members came back and they went, wow, this is like a throne. And I was like, hey, you know, it kind of is. And they're like, Queenie, you're in. And so, and it stuck. I mean, like, it just stuck. And so I have a collection of tiaras that is Queen Elizabeth, I promise you. It is hilarious. So everything they ever did for me was always centered around Queenie. And, it, you know, I even have an email address personally that's SB Queenie. So that just stuck. And so that's how that came to be. And then queen bee, and my husband calls me the queen, and it's just, it's everywhere. So I was privileged to have that name put upon me.
Well, I guess they say when the tiara fits, right?
Yes.
All right, Sharon, well, we're going to go on the hot lap. So if you're going on a road trip, you're in the left seat. What are you driving?
In the left seat, what am I driving? Well, I'm driving a Corvette.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which one? What generation?
Oh my gosh. I would have to now go with the C8. Good grief. Driving that mid-engine for the first time, I walked out of that and I was like, oh my God, I have to have one. And my husband said, "Let's get the C7. What is wrong with you?" And I'm like, you don't understand the difference. And I cannot wait to drive this new Z06. It's got to be insane. And so, you know, my husband swears up and down, we don't have near enough insurance. So yeah, I'd have to have a C8 all day long. And I don't even have to drive the Z06 to know I'd want that one.
So you're headed on a road trip in a mid-engine Corvette. Where are you headed?
You know, I have to admit, and I hate to admit this, but I have not done the Tail of the Dragon. And so I have now understood what that is and where it's at. And I am doing that I want to drive that really badly. And then my second choice would be in Hawaii. Because I love Hawaii, and the roads there that take you all around the islands would be so much fun in a Corvette. That'd be pretty amazing, I would think.
Who's your passenger on this road trip?
Gosh, that's a hard one, because of course I'd take my husband. I take him everywhere. He's my best friend. So can I split? Can I take him on part of it? And then
it's your road trip.
Oh my gosh. I would take him for sure. At least for part of it. My daughters would totally be into that. And of course my mother, anything daddy wanted to do anywhere, anyhow, mama was always right there. And then I wish I could take my dad. That would be so fun. My family is my world. I'm sure you've gathered that in this time together. And so there are no finer people that I want to spend my time with, and let them see the world through the lenses that I look at them and see how it feels to drive and see the world that way. Yeah, I'd want to take all of them. I'd have to split the trip up with all of them, I guess.
What are you playing on the radio?
Country music, girl. That's all there is. George Strait, baby. Come on.
That's right.
He's my fave. And then the girls have really got me turned on to Cody Johnson, because he's kind of the new young version of George in many ways. So if you're not familiar with Cody Johnson, check him out.
What's your favorite road snack?
Love me some trail mix, as long as it has peanut M&Ms in it.
And Sharon, I love how you said that, spending this time together. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and I want to close down with this one thing, having gotten to know you a little bit over these last minutes spent together. If you could have one conversation with your dad, what would you tell him?
Thanks for everything you taught me. I am grateful to have had you as my dad. You did a fine job. And I hope I've made you proud, because I love you and I miss you every day.
She is the CEO and president of the National Corvette Museum, Sharon Browner, on the Women Shifting Gears podcast, driven by Hemmings. Thank you for listening to the Women Shifting Gears podcast, driven by Hemmings. Hemmings, your marketplace for the car collector enthusiast since 1954. This podcast is produced by GS Events.